That old man River, he don't say nothing. He must know something. He just keeps rolling. He keeps on rolling along. He don't plant taters. He don't plant cotton, and them that plant 'em is soon forgotten. But old man River, he keeps on rolling along. You and me, we sweat and strain, body all aching and racked with pain. Tote that barge, lift that bale, get a little drunk, and you'll land in jail. I get weary and sick of trying. I'm tired of living, but I'm feared of dying. But old man River, he keeps on rolling along. Hello, everyone. I am Chuck Gregory, and this is the New American Dream Radio Show, and we are streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. It's listener-supported radio, so make sure you head on over to revolution.radio or freedomslips.com. Show them some love. They deserve your support. I am proud now to introduce my friend and co-host, Mike Palachek, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. Tonight we welcome these special guests, Frank Cordero, Philip Ferruggio, Richard Flamer, Jim Fetzer, and Thomas Wortman. So this Thursday evening, we are gathering for the New American Dream Radio Show in Fort Lauderdale, in Port Orange, in Des Moines, Iowa, in northern Minnesota, in Madison, Wisconsin, in Cleveland, Ohio, in San Cristobal de las Casas, Chiapas, Mexico, and wherever you are. My recommended list for tonight from the Corbett Report: the CFR loves domestic propaganda. The former editor of Time, former Undersecretary of State for Public Policy, thinks the U.S. government propagandizing its own citizens is just fine and dandy. And where did he deliver these remarks? At the CFR, of course. Shocking, I know. The Corbett Report. From Richard Dolan, YouTube: ufology turned upside down. The Admiral Wilson leaks. Richard Dolan. Jimmy Dore, D-O-R-E, YouTube: the New York Times scaremongering people away from YouTube. Jimmy Dore. From Scott Creighton, YouTube: Julian Assange, when a CIA asset is the last hope of American journalism. Scott Creighton. The June issue of Penn Magazine is now available. Find it at pennmagazine.us. Penn Magazine is named in honor of Penn Jones Jr., a small-town journalist, newspaper reporter, editor, publisher, one of the first researchers into the John F. Kennedy murder, an honest newsman who did not lie to us. Mike Palachek, editor, Chuck Gregory, publisher, PENM magazine.us.
Our first guest of the evening is Philip Ferruggio. Phil joins us each week from Port Orange, Florida, and Phil publishes his columns all over the internet. Just search on Google for Philip Ferruggio. That's F-A-R-R-U-G-G-I-O. And now here he is, Philip Ferruggio, with It's the Empire, Stupid.
Good evening, working stiffs. Various shades of black and green. The hit film of 2018 was Peter Farrelly's Green Book. The film takes place in 1962 and was based on a true story about an Italian-American bouncer from the famous Copacabana New York City nightclub securing a temporary job as the chauffeur bodyguard for a popular black musician. He is needed because the trio is going to be anchored on a tour of the Midwest and Deep South. Despite some overdone stereotypes of New York City Italian-American families, the film captures the dark mood of racism in our country, especially in the South. Those not old enough to recall the extent of this racism of that time, the film delivers 1,000%. In the beginning of the movie, we also see a touch of the anti-Semitism of that day and of now also, when an Italian mob boss refers to the owner of the Copacabana, Jewish American Jules Padel, as a Jew bastard. Sadly, prejudice did and does flow from one ethnic group towards others. Those who run this empire count on that to keep with their age-old plan to divide and conquer the working stiffs they control. Keep them hating each other and they'll forget about hating us so much. During the trip down south, the pair get stopped one night during a heavy rain by two local southern cops. With guns drawn, the older of the two deputies shouts to the driver, Tony Lip, to get out of the car in the pouring rain. He then yells to his partner to get the passenger, the black musician, out also. The young deputy states that there is no need to have the passenger get out, but he's shouted down by his partner. As Doc Shirley, the musician, and Tony Lip are standing in this monsoon, Tony Lip asks the deputy why they were pulled over. He is told, at gunpoint, that there is a sundown rule in that town which forbids niggers from being out past sundown. The deputy questions why Tony Lip is driving a nigger and what they are doing in his town. When the deputy finds out that Tony Lip is Italian, he tells Tony that by being Italian, he is a half a nigger, whereupon Tony Lip floors him with one punch, and the pair are arrested. The film captures the extent of Jim Crow segregation at that time. The black star is treated with flattery by the places he is hired to perform in. Yet, he is not allowed to use the bathrooms reserved for whites or to eat in the regular dining room. His dressing room is really just a closet compared to those he would use up north. Of course, heaven forbid if he were to stay in anything but run-down, colored-only hotels. This is all a revelation to someone like Tony Lip, yet he himself begins to realize the subtle segregation and obvious racism that had always existed in his own Bronx neighborhood. Both men slowly draw closer to each other through this horrific experience. There are various levels to this great film. What attracted me was the message, as covert as it may have been, that all working stiffs are really just niggers to those who run things. No matter how much prestige or monetary gain one has accumulated, if one is not born and bred within the blue-blooded club, acceptance is futile. The movers and shakers of empire will co-opt the few who climb the ladder of accomplishment, yet never allow them to eat in their upper-class dining room. This Anglophile system has been with us since perhaps our inception as a republic. They allow the other ethnic servants of empire to do just that. Behind all the Jews of finance and banking, the Dagos, the Micks, the Krauts, Spicks, and Niggers in politics, the military, media, sports, high-tech, agriculture, and manufacturing, behind them all are the descendants of royalty who have always run things American. They pull the strings of this phony two-party, one-party political system and always have. A scene in Robert De Niro's film, The Good Shepherd, echoed this fact. When Matt Damon, as the blue-blood CIA man, pays a visit to the Joe Pesci character playing a mafia leader, Pesci asks him. He says, quote, "We Italians got our families and we got the church. The Irish got their homeland, the Jews their tradition, even the niggers, they get their music. What do you people have?" Matt Damon answers him, "The United States of America and the rest of you are just visitors." Thank you.
And now we get the view from Uncle Bill's front porch. Conspiracies are real. There are many more of them than people are aware. Just Google, for example, Operation Gladio or the Northwoods Project. These conspiracies alone are sufficient to chastise those uninformed Western peoples who go around saying our government would never kill its own people. False flag attacks are used by governments in order to pursue secret agendas that they cannot publicly acknowledge. If President George W. Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney had said, we are going to attack Iraq and a half dozen other countries in order to exercise hegemony over the Middle East, steal their oil, and clear the path for Israel to steal the entirety of the West Bank of Palestine, diverting taxpayers' resources from serving the American people into the pockets of the armaments industries and spilling the blood of your parents, spouses, children, and siblings, even the American sheeple would have resisted.
Instead, following the famous advice of Hitler's chief propagandist, they said, our country has been attacked. Generally speaking, an observant person with a bit of education can recognize a false flag attack. However, few people pay attention beyond what the official media says. And the media no longer investigates and questions, but simply repeats the official story. Therefore, only a few realize what has really happened, and when these few open their mouths, they are discredited as conspiracy theorists. This method of control might be wearing thin. There have been so many false flag terrorist attacks in the 21st century that there are now thousands of experts labeled as conspiracy theorists. The neoconservatives who controlled the George W. Bush regime called for a new Pearl Harbor so that they could begin their wars of conquest in the Middle East. A new Pearl Harbor is what 9/11 gave them. The charge conspiracy theory is used to prevent investigation.
9/11 was not investigated. The Boston Marathon bombing was not investigated. A scripted story was issued and repeated by the media. The San Bernardino shootings were not investigated. Again, a pre-scripted story took the place of investigation. The success of false flag attacks in the U.S. led to their use in the U.K. and France. The Charlie Hebdo affair was not investigated, and the official explanation makes no sense. The story was closed with all the loose ends dangling. For example, why did a French police official investigating the crime allegedly commit suicide in his police office in the early hours of the morning, and why was his family denied the autopsy report? What happened to his disappeared story?
Dear Western peoples, if you wish to be able to walk down the streets of your cities without being accosted by police, demanded to present identity papers, searched, detained indefinitely, or assassinated without due process of law, if you wish to be able to express your opinion about your government and its use of your tax payments, if you wish to be able to discuss current affairs or your personal affairs without being recorded by the NSA or the equivalent in your own country or by both, if you wish to live in the freedom that was achieved in the West after centuries of struggle, wake up. Find time from less meaningful pursuits to become aware of what is being stolen from you. It is late in the game. If you do not stand up for truth, you will have no freedom, as there is no freedom without truth. The View from Uncle Bill's Front Porch, sponsored by homemade apple pie in the bright red can. And now Revolution College, Thursday evenings in the basement of the abandoned humanities building. Tonight's Revolution College lesson, Debbie L., the Sane Progressive. YouTube and BitChute.
From Debbie L. When I started doing these videos about 3 years ago during the Bernie Sanders campaign, I very much considered myself progressive and left. But through these past 3 years, I really have morphed that party labels are pretty meaningless in a system so usurped by corruption. So So now my videos are more not about party politics, but about trying to expose the corruption, how the corruption works, how it has seized different aspects of our government, how we can move forward to understand what is actually happening, so we can finally address what are the real obstacles for the American people to have any power anymore. It is a very dangerous time in our country's history right now. People are starting to be very afraid. People are talking in whispers. We are very much living in a climate of intimidation and fear, and this is very much a silencing tactic so that we are starting to self-censor. Very Orwellian times. The American people have been playing a game of pretend with ourselves. We are propping up a collective delusion where we are not addressing the elephant in the room because it scares people, and people don't know what to do about it. Since 2001, when the towers came down, this country, instead of keeping our wits, were subjected to a very deliberate propaganda campaign, a fear-mongering campaign, a disinformation campaign. We got swept up in this mantra of patriotism and the threat. You're either with us or you're with the terrorists. So thus, you become the enemy. You have to disallow the law of physics to believe the official story of 9/11. We still, to this day, talk about 9/11 under our breath. We've gone along with all these massive rights grabs against us. Anyone who has investigated it knows the official story is a lie. We're to believe there have been all these mass shooting events in the past couple of years. Right now, post-Parkland shooting, we're literally watching the same thing that happened after 9/11 again. A story that if you critically evaluate, it is so clear that the story is so contradictory and there are so many red flags that if we were a sane country, we would not be talking about more rights being relinquished. We would be demanding to understand what happened before moving forward in this same absurd pattern. There is nothing disrespectful to anyone or crazy about objectively analyzing information and having a logical discussion about it. If there are red flags that demand that we need more answers, you follow them. It has nothing to do with right or left. It has to do with keeping our heads so we can see what's before our very eyes. If you really want to know what happened, you go watch the footage of what they showed you happened. Because if you go to the local WPLG Local 10 news clip, they have 4 hours. It does not show a single person who had a gunshot wound being carried out. It does show empty gurneys being loaded in as rescued. It does show individuals with absolutely no sign of injury or any medical equipment whatsoever. It shows that. It shows what 12 witnesses on national media told us. It documents a drill. The drill that the students and parents and teachers said was scheduled that day. One girl said they told us to go outside so they could start shooting up. And there were army guys there, and they were piling bodies into the corner. Simulated. We have to say the emperor has no clothes. The emperor has no clothes. You've got to say it, and you've got to say it out loud. They never actually address or refute the content of the claims. They say, oh, these crazy, awful people are saying crazy, awful things. We're not. But before you even listen to what we are pointing out, first words out of their mouth is, you're crazy, because they listen to this media. What you're seeing right now is nothing more than a cheap power trick. They're not hiding it. They are counting. They're counting on the fact that people could not believe something like this could happen. And so that's it. It disappears before our eyes. People are sick of this. People are seeing this. This is the only shot we have right now. The only means that my videos have any value is if tens and hundreds of thousands of people speak out.
We'll see you next Thursday night, the next session of Revolution College, underground in the abandoned Humanities Building. Them that's got shall cut. Them that's not shall lose. So the Bible said, and it still is news. Mama may have, Papa may have. God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own. Yes, the strong shall get while the weak ones fade. Empty pockets don't ever make the grade. Mama may have and Papa may have. God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own. When you got money, you got lots of friends crowding round your door. When the money's gone and the spending ends, they won't be around no more. Rich relations give you a crust of bread and such. You can help yourself, but don't take too much. Mama may have and Papa may have. God bless the child that's got his own, has got his own. And now for another episode of The Adventures of Deputy and Candidate for Sheriff of Pecan County, Buddy Q. Twinkle. Buddy is patrolling the War on Terror Memorial Highway in South Central Alabama. He's sitting in a grove of trees, can't see a thing. He's on Twitter on his phone, chatting with a Kremlin. Every once in a while, he has to go stop somebody, but then it's back to the trees and Twitter. He says he believes he needs to stay in constant contact. At 10 a.m. every day, Buddy goes to Waffle House, has his large scattered hash browns covered in melted cheese with sausage and two eggs, 930 calories with two coffees. He waits looking out the window by himself, and then when the time is right, he goes and plugs the men's toilet. Of course he does. Buddy is a Russian spy. Stay tuned for next week's episode of The Adventures of Deputy and Candidate for Sheriff of Pecan County, Buddy Q. Twinkle. Sponsored by Lemon Fresh Borax, also sponsors of On Babushka Kalashnikov's Corner, The View from My Perushki Cart. When your dogs tell you the Russians pooped in the hallway while you were at work, we're there for you, protecting the homeland. Lemon Fresh Borax in the fading yellow box.
Our next guest of the show is Frank Cordero. Frank Cordero joins us each week from the Des Moines Catholic Worker, Des Moines, Iowa. And we're going to hear right now the conversation between Frank Cordero in Des Moines and Chuck Gregory in Fort Lauderdale.
Chuck.
Sorry, I missed. Here we go again.
Yo, Chuck.
Well, hello, Frank.
Uh-oh. Well, let me just get myself. I'm still in L.A.
Okay.
And I'm in my last full day here, going home tomorrow.
Yeah.
And are we? Is I don't know what time is it? Is because it's like at 2 o'clock here, I think. Well, what's it out there?
It's 6 o'clock here, so it's 3 o'clock there.
Got it. Well, great. So you're ready for an interview, and I'm ready to give it to you. What the heck?
Okay, good. So go for it.
Yes, last week I was in L.A., just gave you a bit of a brief introduction to the place. I've been here a week, 10 days, well, now 2 weeks. So a number of things that the folks need to know, that it's a beautiful day here. I'm literally in their big house, and I'm looking at the skyline, I'm enjoying the legality of marijuana in California. So now I'm probably on the airways,
nice.
And I'm telling you, I'm high, and I'm having a great time, and it's entirely legal.
Yay.
It's just, it's got me emotionally involved, you know, long time hippie, whatever, 68, most of my life, you know, having to engage with the question as to whether to smoke or not, legality. It's just the first time that I've been in a state where you just can do it. It's just amazing. So everybody's in listening view. If you do have a political issue, this one could be winnable, and I suggest do what you can to make it happen wherever you're at. That's one thing. That's silly, and mostly indicative of that I'm on vacation and I'm having a good time. I'm blessed to have a place to be. The richness of the L.A. Catholic Worker, Jeff Dietrich, Catherine Morrison, folks that have been at it for now close to 50 years, they were like 7 years ahead of me, at least Jeff was, and Catherine. Catherine's 85 and Jeff is 73. So these aren't spring chickens, and they're just it was just been great to be with them. The wisdom to share with folks just the difficulties of communal life, intergenerational stuff, all the things that that Catholic workers go through. It's just always good to have mentors who've been there before and know the pain. And the difficulties of trying to keep places like this going. So all of that's been rich for me.
I hope, Frank, that you got to talk about some of the rewards of doing this for such a long time as well.
Well, I not only got to talk about it, we're doers in rewards.
Well,
so
I know you
I
are.
Must have been there,
I know it.
I must have been at their kitchen five times helped them do their serving. And it's really a nice place. I mean, a garden-like place in the middle of Skid Row. There are issues here that are boiling over, national issues, flashpoint issues, because here, unlike other cities, they run them out when they're living on the streets in tents in downtown areas. But this crowd has claimed this territory, and more and more homeless people are coming into L.A. I just did a study where they spent almost $500 million on them to deal with it last year, in the increase of about 16%, despite their efforts. And the tents that are lining up the sidewalks and the streets down on Skid Row, they come through every 2 weeks. People have to move and change, but they come right back within hours to reclaim the space. I think this is a really an interesting place to be watching in the next few years, because it's going to be an epicenter about how this country deals with homeless people, discarded people. So very, very interesting dynamics going on. And I come from Iowa, you know, so, you know, when we do our Catholic worker thing in Iowa, we eventually run up against industrial agriculture and militarism. And here in L.A., you know, militarism's everywhere. So they've got their military places where they've gone and protest for years. But their issue is homelessness. You know, it's serious homelessness. They live in a little city of homeless people, 6,000 people on the streets in this area. That's no small thing. So that's been an eye opener for me. And the other thing is the we're from different parts of the country, but it's like visiting. For me, I'm a very familiar man. I really have an appreciation for large extended families. My Italian American family on both sides is very much like that. And the Catholic worker has become that for me. And like I'm visiting all my West Coast cousins, first and second cousins. And now that I'm old, they got kids. It's just a rich experience. So if I'm to say I'm just grateful for the venue I have and the friends I have in my movement that will host me and let me whine and cry, and then they treat me now nice. They take me out to dinner, just been treating me a lot, for me, like a king. So I really feel good about that, and I'm getting ready to go back into the life back home. One of the things that I worked on was a newspaper. The next article I'm writing for the Via Pontius, and I got a copy of my high school newspaper 50 years ago, my senior year, and the headlines was about my father who died of a heart attack during that year. He was the athletic coach. And it was a wonderful issue. My father's pictures, testimonials to my father, every one of them true. I know I'm biased, but I do believe that. And then on the opinion page, it all came back to me, the kind of political scene that was going on. When my senior year, 1968-69, in this neighborhood where the school was, the old school, is the current neighborhood I'm in. It was a very racially charged, poverty, people of color neighborhood. In the 60s, 69, we were trying to shut the school down and move it to the west side. That was the big project that my people, we wanted a bigger school, better athletes. I had no idea. I was pretty much a mental midget when it came to being political. So one of the five smartest guys in our school write this underground paper called The Sober Eye. They say that maybe Darlene should stay, that's the school, in the neighborhood as a sign of our support for folks of color and low income. And they said, listen to this, maybe we should be against the Vietnam War. Well, this underground paper went viral in 1969. That meant the conservative radio host put it on his radio and said there were communists at Dowling High School. And then on our campus, all hell broke loose. And I'm reminded that the very first demonstration I ever helped to organize was a pro-USA, pro-Dowling High School demo on our campus. And we were like screaming for blood for these guys to get them kicked off. Luckily, we did not do that physically, but the cameras were there and everything. And then on the page, there more than half the class, my name included, signed a petition against the guys who put this paper out. All of the opinion things were against these guys. And when it came to graduation, the smart people, the guys in the top, 5%, got what they call the Aquinas key.
Huh.
These guys, the five of them, did not get theirs.
Huh.
And instead, I got an Aquinas key for what I did on the student council. I wasn't nearly smart enough, I can tell you that. But they invented this thing so I could get it. It was all politically motivated, and I was completely, emerged in the athletic culture and the pro-USA culture, and terribly frightened of black people and African-American people and the racial stuff that was going on. That was 50 years ago. Now, the irony is I'm living in that same neighborhood. I'm serving the very people I was afraid of. And if you were to take a vote, who was the least likely guy in our class to end up a lifelong hippie, ponytail, peace activist, jailbird? It would not have been me. And I wrote of that, and then I said, but the consistent thing for me was my father's life. My dad lived a life of service and purpose and meaning for the people the kids he taught. He was always trying to teach more important things than baseball. I have those same attitudes and attributes. I think the only difference between my dad and me is that, I believe in God. I just have changed my understanding of God. I've changed my understanding of family. I've changed my understanding of nation in church. But I'm just committed to all of those things, which my father taught me to be. It's just for me, it was a time to spend these days going back and trying to figure out how the hell I got here.
we've changed, right? But that is an amazing story, Frank. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thanks, Chuck.
Always loved to talk with you. And hey, have a safe trip back home.
Thanks, brother.
I'm really.
See you all.
And hey, smoke a big bud for me.
Yeah, man, it's legal under Chuck. I know. Okay. All right. Bye.
And now we'll go from Catholic worker to Catholic worker. From Frank Cordero in Los Angeles, we're going to go to Richard Flamer in Chiapas, Mexico, at the Chiapas Catholic Worker.
This month I wanted to talk about art. Dorothy Day was fond of recalling the phrase of Dostoevsky that the world will be saved by beauty. Over the last 10 years, the phrase has taken on a new meaning for me. In all phases of the arts, I'm constantly amazed at the way of what the French call frisson affects my life. Frisson is that notion that comes sweeping or coursing through your mind, come out of the amazing world with art, with a song, with a fine sentence. Recently, I heard a young lady, a teenager, do a rendition of Someday We'll All Be Free, Wayne McDonald, in the style of Nina Simone. She sang with confidence, verve, and sweetly, with a fine pace and a strong voice. The frisson that I felt that first time I heard her has returned with each subsequent encounter. There's something about the young doing old songs that thrills me, though it doesn't negate the joy of those older singers. The wonderful warmth that comes from Richie Havens singing the Beatles, to my mind, much better than the originals. I often think that originality is overrated. The House of the Rising Sun has been done by many, but each time it is sung, it has its own sound. As a young man, I had the pleasure of hearing Louis Prima and Keeley Smith in a concert in Las Vegas. What I took away from that time was a song called Just the Gigolo, later done by David Lee Roth, but also by Simone Signoret in a movie with David Bowie. Each time it was performed, it was unique. If a good batter in baseball is batting 300, that means he hits 3 out of every 10 pitches. We call him good. If a major artist turns out 10 paintings in a year, would all of them be good? In the visual art world, the name is the fame. I think of the paintings of Pablo Picasso. Can recall a special wonder, the painting Guernica, just before his return to Spain from the Museum of Modern Art. It was magnificent. Yet others of Picasso's work leave me cold. I can still recall my R&R in Sydney, Australia, after the horror of Vietnam, where I encountered one of the paintings of Joseph Albers, Homage to a Square. With the violent orange and yellows, I simply stared at it, burst out crying. Or walking through the Jossam Museum in Omaha with a 7-year-old boy, we stopped at a small Jackson Pollock grit painting, and the child said to me, "Boy, that painting has power." And it did. I don't think of history as a science, but an art being rewritten constantly. A recent biography of Howard Zinn by Martin Duberman reminded me of the various ways of interpreting my past. First, I was at Goddard College with Martin Duberman when we were undergraduates. I did not know him well, but ran into him occasionally. He and I were both interested in Black Mountain College. He later wrote a book about the school. Well, I merely sold old books. The biography of Zinn was a fine work of scholarship, but I found myself quibbling over passages of the work that dealt with what Zinn did not cover in his work. In other words, gay rights and feminism. Both subjects that interested Duberman. On a different note, Ron Hanson authored many novels that are quite disparate in themes, but is probably best known for his novel of Jesse James. I find myself rereading his work on religion and theology. His novel, Marietta in Ecstasy, is a marvel of religious passion, while his recent book, Exiles, takes us to a modern reading of Gerard Manley Hopkins and his role in modern poetry. Prior to reading Jonathan Spence, I knew very little on the history of China, but I've always been interested in systems of memory. In the Memory Palace of Matteo Ricci, I became intrigued with the entrance of Christianity into the closed world of China. The works of Spence have increasingly been read by me for a myriad of reasons, mostly, of course, for the quality of his writing. Artificial genres exist in all forms of art. In music, pop is derided by some, country by others, opera by others yet. It's all music, some good, some not. In literature, children's books are derided by teenagers. Well, mysteries are not serious literature. So why do these artificial links exist? I suspect it is the nature of Americans to classify, for book dealers to have a way to divide their shelves, for music stores to separate their bins. What makes the novels of James Lee Burke crime novels? Should William Faulkner be reclassified as a writer of horror works? Is Phoebe Snow a singer of jazz? Salvador Dali made hundreds of lithographs for money. Does it mean he wasn't a great artist? Statesboro Blues was written by Blind Willie McDowell in 1928. Taj Mahal recorded their version of the song in 1968. Yet the most played on the radio, the most popular version, was the Allman Brothers Band. One of my favorite works of fiction is Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man by James Joyce. His collection of short stories is superb as well. Yet I find his Ulysses boring and Finnegan's Wake unreadable. So, okay, in my book, he's still batting 500. Who can tell where the influence of Dashiell Hammett ends and outright copying begins? Does it matter that Ross McDonald was Canadian? I suppose part of it, the frisson, comes from an individual history, while a collective memory plays a role as well. Growing up around Los Angeles, I read all of Walter Mosley's Mysteries of E.Z. Rollins, where most of the stories take place. When I joined the Army, the bus I was riding in for Ford to work passed through the first day of rioting in Watts. My only memory of that day was the disorder of flying bottles as we sped through the middle of the rioting. Does it matter that Walter Mosley, one of the directors of the Goddard College, where I went to school? I remember John Gregory Dunn's True Confessions because I know the terrain so well. I can remember listening to my father as he spoke of the corruption of the L.A. Police Department and the Catholic Church during the 1950s, the subject of Dunn's work. As a working photographer, I mostly worked in black and white film. The time it took me to learn the basics and experiment with various films was extensive. I learned along the way that I was not much good with color. That is, color print film was always a mix of only six colors, while slide film had a much wider range of colors with less compromise. I often wondered what my fear of color had as a base. Recalling my 15 years as a rare book dealer, I had seen hundreds, if not thousands, of photographic images in various museums I visited. Those visits trained my eyes to think in black and white. My limitation with color went back to my visions of Joseph Albers. Albers' work was tremendously influencing many artists, especially his book on how color works. So I limited my slides to working in just two or three colors, or a cacophony of 20 different colors. These days, I listen to a lot of music, all kinds. The blues, early rock and roll, ballads, opera, string quartets, and more. The books I read are many. Usually I have two or three works I peruse each day. I continue to read my favorite poets, Dante, Eliot, Auden, Blake, with regularity. I have a number of books from private presses like Abattoir Press, Stonewall Press, whose work is impeccable. There's something sensual about reading to tell us when the work is hand-bound, printed on a hand press with handmade paper. The art of typesetting is not too distant from furniture design, especially now that I have my own wood shop and can design and build a successful table or chair. The novels I usually rush through, though I find myself rereading some of my favorites, Raymond Chandler, Dashiell Hammett, The Child, etc. History sometimes gets short shrift since it's hard to get decent works here in Mexico. Really am up on Mexican history. The faces and the bodies of men and women that I see are a great source of enrichment. A Middle Eastern woman with such lovely olive skin and a magnificent smile struck me last week. A Greek man and his Italian wife are a magnificent couple, though they're now in their 60s with all the faults of age, but incredible charisma between them. At an earlier time in my life, I had the great pleasure of traveling to New York City on various occasions, usually for business, but my evenings were filled with the arts. When I could afford it, I made my way to the cookery to hear Alberta Hunger. I managed to catch Peter Martins and Suzanne Farrell in various ballet performances, but Nureyev in The Afternoon of a Fawn stands out. I was so moved by the two-hour dance at a matinee that I staggered out of the theater, walked 10 blocks in the wrong direction. It was as if I was drunk. What the joy I felt watching Baryshnikov perform his homage to Fred Astaire. To see my wife as she sleeps in the morning still thrills me. My life has been filled with art, from my earliest memories of the Huntington Galleries of San Marino to my weekly visits to the small museums of San Cristobal.
I wish we could hear the other few minutes of Richard's interview, but it's time for the station break. We'll talk to you on the other side.
Our next guest of the show is Jim Fetzer. Jim Fetzer is a retired university professor. He's a radio show host, a reporter. And we're going to hear now from Jim Fetzer in Madison, Wisconsin.
Chuck, Mike, it's great to be with you again. There have been a number of major developments where Mike came down for his deposition where Leonard Posner flew in from Florida. It was rather fascinating to have the opportunity to question him, as I had earlier questioned Wayne Carver. There were a number of significant aspects to this. Now is the situation where both sides have submitted their responses to one another's motion for summary judgment, and as of yesterday, our replies to one another's responses to our motions for summary judgment. What I think is most significant concerns the complaint itself that was lodged against me, which appears to have no merit, reinforced by additional research. In the complaint, which is a part of the court files in Wisconsin, because this suit was filed in Dane County, where I reside, also where we have the capital of Wisconsin, Madison, we find in the introduction to the complaint, defendant Fetzer has a long history of harassing plaintiff and other Sandy Hook parents with defamatory lies and has slandered plaintiff repeatedly in the years since the tragedy of Sandy Hook. Of course, all of that is nonsense. It's a political spin on doing serious research about Sandy Hook, where, as I like to explain, there are four steps or stages in scientific inquiries, to wit, puzzlement, something doesn't fit in with your background knowledge, and leaves you in a state of concern about what really happened. In this instance, we had an event that was presented as a mass child shooting, but where we had coming in the footage from Newtown a whole host of contrary indications, including a sign that said everyone must check in. We had porta potties already in place. We had pizza and bottled water available at the firehouse. There were many who had name tags on lanyards. There were parents bringing children to the scene. No parent would bring their child to the scene of a child shooting massacre. And when we discovered the FEMA manual for a two-day exercise, a drill on the 13th, beginning at 8 a.m. and ending at 11:59, it states right in the manual, which I included in the book as Appendix A, everyone must check in with the controller upon arrival. FEMA exercises provide refreshments in restrooms as part of their standard operating procedures. The players are identified by color-coded name tags on lanyards. So we have a lot of reason to think this might not have been a child shooting exercise after all. Indeed, when I edited the book, which has 13 contributors, including six current or retired PhD professors, we established in the course of our research that the school had been closed by 2008. It was loaded with asbestos and other biohazards, damaged by a hurricane. There was even a major flood in the area in 2007, that there were no students there, and that it was a FEMA exercise to promote gun control. I mean, anyone who thinks that six PhDs couldn't figure out whether or not an elementary school was or was not open in 2008, I think ought to reconsider, because that's a credential that certifies your competence at conducting research. We even know from aerial photographs of the parking lot that Sandy Hook Elementary School could not have been legally operating in 2012. It had none of the now all too familiar blue and white parking areas for the handicapped, no handicap signage. It had
exits and entrances that were not wheelchair accessible. This means Sandy Hook Elementary School was not compliant with American for Disability Act requirements, including both state and federal law, as I verified at the time. It could not have been legally operating as a school. Therefore, we merely undertook research to figure out what really happened. We weren't targeting the parents. We weren't targeting Leonard Posner or even Noah, though it would turn out, of course, that he would be a prominent figure. He has made himself in many ways the face of the Sandy Hook event with all of his pleas, including for donations for his son, Noah Posner. Now, the complaint continues to claim this case focuses narrowly on one falsehood that plaintiff circulated a forgery of NP's death certificate. One of the oddities of the complaint is that he does not refer to his son as Noah Posner. He refers to him as NP. That's pretty odd. When we get to the death certificates, we'll find other oddities about them as well that suggest things are not on the up and up. Very, very peculiar. In any case, by way of the factual background, plaintiff claims prior to undertaking such responses in which he was defending himself from attacks, plaintiff had no meaningful public presence. Well, that's contradicted by the discovery that while the shooting took place ostensibly on 14 December 2012, Obama came to Connecticut and signed no less than 23 executive orders to constrain our access to weapons under the Second Amendment. Already on the 16th of January 2013, that's a month and 2 days later. Well, precisely a month later, 2 days before Obama appeared on the scene, Lenny Posner authored an open letter to the president about gun control. It's very clear this was all an orchestrated effort to promote the Democratic gun control agenda. Indeed, one of our contributors to the book, which anyone can download for free by simply entering its title in their search bar, Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, and they can have the first edition right on their desktop at no charge. Paul Preston was himself a school administrator who'd supervised drills and was very suspicious about what he saw being broadcast from Newtown that day. He reached out to his contacts in the Obama Department of Education, all of whom confirmed to him that it had been a drill, that no children had died, that it had been done to promote gun control. That's coming directly from the Obama Department of Education. The complaint also states the second edition of Nobody Died at Sandy Hook accuses plaintiff of issuing and or possessing a forged copy of NP's death certificate. In particular, page 183 of Nobody Died at Sandy Hook states, Noah Posner's death certificate is a fake, which we have proven on a dozen or more grounds. And page 232, the book states, Mr. Posner sent her a death certificate, which turned out to be a fabrication. At page 242, it states, as many Sandy Hook researchers are aware, the very document Posner circulated in 2014 with its inconsistent tones, fonts, and clear digital manipulations was clearly a forgery. Not only that, but they cite a passage from the Sandy Hook Memoranda Series for the President of the United States, edited by Robert David Steele, a post there dated August 5th, 2018, where defendant Fetzer made the following, they claim, false statement. It, NP's death certificate, turned out to be a fabrication with the bottom half of a real death certificate and the top half of a fake, with no file number and the wrong estimated time of death at 11 a.m., when officially the shooting took place between 9 Well, in this case, I wrote 9:35 and 9:40. Actually, it appears to have been from 9:30 to 9:40, or in some versions, 9:30 to 9:41. According to the complaint, an official death certificate attached to the complaint does not differ in any material respect from the one released publicly by the plaintiff. Now, that's a rather fascinating assertion, because it turns out that the one that was attached to the complaint had, for example, a file number, whereas the one that was in the possession of Kelly Watt from Lenny Posner did not. If there is ever a significant a material difference between two death certificates, having or not having a file number obviously qualifies as one. There's much more now, but on Monday, Mike will join me at the courthouse right here in Madison, where we'll be making oral arguments, and I hope to place this entire matter to rest once and for all. Mike, Chuck, great being here with you, my friends. Thanks so much.
Our next guest of the show is Thomas Wortman. Thomas Wortman is the director of the Ohio MUFON, Mutual UFO Network. And Thomas Wortman joins us each month from Cleveland, Ohio. So now, Thomas Wortman of MUFON from Cleveland.
All right, we're dialing him now. It should be coming up.
Hello, Chuck.
Well, hello, Thomas. Welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show. You're on the air.
Great. You know, I'm sitting here looking at all my computer monitors. By the way, I've got five computer monitors in front of me right now, Chuck. And I'm looking over all the UFO news, and the story that's still really making a lot of headlines is the Navy's announcement of changing guidelines reporting UFOs, or as they're calling them now, UAPs, unidentified aerial phenomena. A lot of this all comes from an incident which originally occurred back in 2004, where Navy pilots off the coast of California observed unidentified flying objects and attempted to intercept them. And the pilot, actually a couple of pilots now have come out and started talking about that event back in 2004. One has made his name known. His name is David Fravor. The other one, pilot, is remaining anonymous because she is still on active duty yet. Well, the story is now expanded. And there's another video. There's three videos that originally came out. Two were from the Nimitz carrier group back in 2004. The third video has been stated to have come from the Theodore Roosevelt, which was conducting exercises off the coast of Virginia down to Florida between 2014 and 2015. As the information I found right now, it shows that a total of six pilots on that carrier now have come out and talked about intercepting UFOs. Again, seeing things as they're conducting training exercises off the coast. These pilot reports have even gone on to state that at one time, a couple of pilots were trying to intercept one of these objects. The object went between both of the planes. And the way it sounded, it kind of scared the heck out of the pilots for a second, because here this thing is going between two jets, which were roughly about 100 feet apart at the time. So all these events now are starting to trigger the change in the guidelines, because it appears that the Navy is taking the situation much more seriously, that they want to identify what these objects are. They're going into airspace, which is military airspace. They're in areas which we have training exercises being conducted with military aircraft, and it appears that they're concerned that there could be a potential collision between one of these objects and, in this case, one of the UAPs, as they're now calling them. Well, this story came out roughly about a month ago, and it's continued to get traction. It's appeared in a lot of the major news networks out there. But one of the things about the UFO community is you're always going to find conspiracy somewhere. One of the individuals who was involved with the program of supposedly investigating and pursuing these unknown objects with the Pentagon, his name was Luis Elizondo. He reportedly ran a program roughly referred to as the Advanced Aerial Threat Identification Program. He's come out. He said, yes, I was the guy. I was the one in charge. I was the one who was involved with these groups on air. And Politico, their Defense Department coverage, went in this case to, you know, describe what Elizondo was doing out there. Well, like I said, you never have an end of conspiracies. Now they're digging more into Elizondo, and Politico is the only one that has come out and said, yeah, this guy was one that supposedly ran the program. Well, one of the people that they talked to get their information, his name is escaping me right now. Okay, is Dana White. He said that Elizondo ran the program, but now this Dana White has stepped down from his position in the Trump administration. He stepped down over charges of misconduct. So now it's casting doubt, in this case, on Elizondo again. Is this guy who he really claimed to be, or is he just some buddy of some unknown position out there? Another individual from the Pentagon has come out and said no, that Elizondo was not involved with a certain area of the Defense Department. He actually resigned from like a different area. So here we go again, Chuck, with the ongoing conspiracies out there. The main thing that we're left with at the end of the day is that we still have Navy pilots reporting things. And according to the pilots, or one of the pilots, I should say, from the Theodore Roosevelt, it wasn't just the sightings that they had off the coast of Virginia and Florida. That carrier group was also deployed over to the Gulf. And they said once they got into the Gulf region, they also had continued sightings again of these objects. And the thing I think about is when you have military aircraft observing these things, if that's the highest tech gear that we possibly have out there, and these sensors are picking the objects up. And according to the groups out there, they sighted up to 80 to 100 UFOs, not all at once, but in groups of like five at a time. So they may have had roughly 20 different incidents where they'd seen groups of five UFOs. So, I mean, that's the really big story that's coming out. I got to talk to some of my friends last weekend, a couple weeks ago, actually, now. And we were talking about this event, and even though that this Elizondo thing has kind of clouded it a little bit, they said still the important thing is you have military personnel coming out and talking about these. And the Navy taking these things so seriously, that now they're changing the guidelines for reporting because they want more pilots to report UFOs. They want to break that stigma, first of all, by referring to them now as UAPs. Break the stigma of UFOs. They want to get the reports in so they can start analyzing the data that they're collecting from radar systems, from infrared cameras, from pilot reports, and they want to put all this stuff together and see what type of information they can generate. The information that it appears they have right now, that they don't know what they're looking at for sure. Nobody's come out and said it is a government project. One of the thoughts has been potentially drones. These objects have been reported moving at hypersonic velocities. And hypersonic means they're traveling at Mach 5, which would put them at over 3,500 miles an hour at altitudes of 30,000 feet. These objects that they've tracked, they also say that they don't appear to have wings. Wings we associate with providing lift to make aircraft travel, providing them, you know, the lift to go up. They also state that these objects that are being tracked are making high degree angle turns, which puts them at a G rate, that's beyond what the human body as we know it can tolerate. So it's making them think that they are some type of a drone-type object out there. Or maybe somebody's developed some technology we're not aware of that they can handle these high G turns that somehow breaks the effects of, like, gravity as we know it, that they can make higher turns at higher velocities. So this story is still going to be ongoing. It appears we're still going to be seeing much more coming out down the road. Recently, History Channel's run a show on this. It's getting into the subject, bringing out information. And supposedly, there's more information that's going to be coming out with the individuals involved. That goes back to Elizondo, Chris Mellon, who worked in the Pentagon. He's also part of the Mellon Bank family. These individuals are going to be divulging more information as we go down the road. So this is a story, Chuck, that's really kind of gotten me excited. But on the other hand, I'm really also concerned that is this something that may kind of blow up later on when they find out that some of the people who were involved with this project weren't who they claimed they were? Or is this just another way of trying to cover up information that was coming out from, in this case, sources? Like maybe trying to cast, let's say, a shadow on the stories coming out by the military pilots and maybe kind of detracting from their stories some to, you know, make people believe that maybe it's a little bit more of a hoax or something else rather than something very, very serious out there. So this is a great story. Something else that came up. Now, I don't know if you've got a spare 50-some million dollars laying around, but NASA also announced that now if you've got a spare 50-some million dollars in change laying around, you can actually go up in one of the SpaceX capsules, possibly as soon as next year, up to the International Space Station. And you can stay up there, of which they've worked out the prices behind it, for roughly about $30,000 a night. I don't know about you, but I'd consider doing it. But I think by the time I got up there, they'd probably have to take and raise the fees a little bit because I'd probably be scared so crapless. I would probably be having one of the biggest, let's say, bowel movements of my life as they launched me up in space. And the other consideration I had is my body's not as in shape as it used to be. And would they bill me extra for like a seat and a half on one of the spaceships going up? But that's another thing that I also thought about is what if they start getting these private pilots going up the International Space Station and these private pilots, as were private astronauts is going to be called, start also reporting UFOs from space. So that's another thing. Will they take and talk about what they've seen? Will they possibly record something? Will they may even have some of their own stories when they come back? One of the other conspiracies there has been that when these incidents are being cited from the ISS, that these stories are being kind of blacked out. They're cutting off possible like news feeds, and we're not receiving the information, the real information on what went on during these sightings. Maybe these private astronauts, as they're going to be called, will take and have stories of their own that they can come out with and bring out to the public. I'm just really curious about that. So we've got kind of a lot going on. And we've even had China now reporting potential UFOs over China. Now, I don't know if we'll get the real solid information about those. But the one that they had cited within the last month, it could be potentially missiles being launched over there, or it could be maybe related to something we don't know. The one problem that we have with reports coming out of China is getting really good, solid information. So we'll just have to wait and see what the story brings out there. So again, Chuck, there's a heck of a lot going on in the UFO community.
Thomas,
we'll just have to see what comes out.
Thank you. It does sound like there's an awful lot going on, and I want to thank you for joining us tonight. We are pretty much out of time. would you like to, you know, tell them anything about where to find you? You have like no time, but just do it real quick.
Okay. If they want to get a hold of me, they can actually go to the MUFON Ohio website. That's where I'm based from. If they contact MUFON Ohio, they can get an email to me that way. That's one of the best ways, Chuck.
All right. Thanks again. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Welcome to our last half hour. The mind of an American rules the world. The president, Warren Buffett, Tiger Woods, Katie Couric, John Stewart, the Michelin man. No, stupid, it's you. You are the king of the world, God, Superman, King Midas, all that. It's you. You are more than just a legend in your mind. You are the man. And when the CIA, through the CIA propaganda machine called Radio Free Europe, or the American Free Press tells you the Russians are coming, or the criminals are coming, or terrorists, or the Iranians, or Iraqis, or Afghans on nuclear-powered blue donkeys, or big bees, and you believe it, well then, Zeke, that's how the world will go. You are powerful, the most powerful Yahoo who has ever lived in the history of living. And you are an idiot. And the world is going to burn. You are not an idiot on purpose, but an idiot nonetheless. The CIA, the persons in the CIA are smart. But they are evil, the actual evil empire. And they control you, the most powerful person in the world. If you were not an idiot, they could not do that. But you are an idiot. And that's a bummer, man. That's a bummer. The moon. We went there and never went back. Makes sense. The same thing happened with the big discovery of the car and the airplane and Hawaii and Las Vegas. And no problem in getting back from the surface of the moon to that main spaceship thing and the technology. I mean, we could do that in the 60s. When computers were as big as rooms and there was no such thing as personal computers, the internet, and we never went back. And hey, wait, let go of me. Hey, there's your warrant. There's a beverage here, man. I have my rights. I'm going to the library. I'm doing a paper. Freaking hall monitors. They think they own the stupid school. And that press conference, wow, Buzz Aldrin, Neil Armstrong, Michael Collins, they should have been like, man, we are so excited to just get back from the moon. We had never tested that moon landing thing and then the takeoff from the moon and then the hookup with the orbiter thing, because how could you practice that? And it all worked like a charm. I'm going to live. And I've been to, like, the moon, man. But they were like, we are so depressed and so shy. And did we see stars or not? Yes, no, yes, I don't know. It's like almost like they were hiding something. Hey, let go of me. I left my pass in my other pants. I told you, man. Goddamn fascists. Tonight's show is dedicated to the idea that Americans don't need to be idiots, but we are. We don't even know who killed John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin King. We don't even know that our own government was involved in the 9/11 attacks, the Oklahoma City bombing, that we killed murdered children at Waco, that Senator Paul Wellstone was murdered. We don't know whether we really landed on the moon. We don't really know if there are beings from other planets flying over our cities and farms. We don't even know that Bigfoot is real. What do we know? Well, we don't know as much as we think we do, but it doesn't need to be that way. Knowledge is power. You can fix stupid. Hand me that socket wrench, will you? Just this past week, the German exchange students, calling themselves the White Rose, took over the local American history classroom 101, third period, before the teacher got there. Sit down, we don't have much time. They will stop us. Okay. Lee Harvey Oswald, James Earl Ray, Sirhan Sirhan, Osama bin Laden are not your enemies. Karl Rove, Barack Obama, George Bush, Dick Cheney, Donald Trump, these are your enemies. These are your lone nuts. Okay, someone's coming. Remember, do your outside reading. Google Oklahoma City bombing. What really happened? Google 9/11 truth. Watch the rules of engagement about Waco. Listen to Jim Fetzer's presentation on the Wellstone assassination. Really, people, this is not silly. It's real. Barack Obama talking about having just killed Osama. Buried at sea. That is silly. George W. Bush not wanting to meet alone with the 9/11 Commission. That is silly. Read Jim Garrison. Don't listen to the nightly news. Watch the frightened astronauts in their press conference. They do not smile after coming back from the moon. Listen to your Green Day people. Okay, sit up straight and take out your textbooks. They're here. This message from your local Coca-Cola company. If a plane would have hit the Pentagon, we would have seen that short film 1,000 times by now on Chevrolet commercials and Miller beer commercials and on commercials somehow juxtaposing the Pentagon, puppy pellets, the Pittsburgh Pirates, and the Popemobile. So no plane hit the Pentagon. And because we know that from the lack of Popemobile prevarications, we can be sure that Bush, Rove, Rumsfeld, et al. Are liars and murderers. And we can include a bunch more folks in there as well. Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, the nice Obama family across the street. They all know the truth and refuse. refuse to tell us. You can't beat the real thing. Always Coca-Cola. Drink Coke.
Well, it's been another long week in Moon Rock Lake, Ohio, my hometown at the end of the empire. Democratic candidate Joe Coffey went to speak in a big school auditorium on a Saturday to a group of Democrats. Joe got up, saw himself in slow motion walking up the step to the crowd's applause. He wished for a railing, reached his shiny wood stage, and headed for the podium safe haven, and his shoes clicked on the wood stage floor. Coffey felt the presence of the people at the long folding table on his left and a sea of upturned white faces on his right. He shook the MC's hand and moved toward the blonde wood podium. Joe placed his papers, adjusted the mic, and looked up to his right where Jane would be, but saw only dark shadows under the balcony overhang area. Hello. Is this on? He smiled. Yeah, my wife and I, Jane. Yeah, she's back over there somewhere. Jane must have stood and waved because some of the others applauded and waved to her. I remember driving through Yankton, South Dakota, Joe continued. It's a time of great personal struggle and uncertainty. I think we were on our way to the Black Hills. I don't think we ever got there. Joe adjusted the microphone, grabbed the sides of the podium as he'd seen the governor do. We stopped at a motel, watched the Tiananmen Square crisis unfold in the television. It was also a time of the destruction of the Berlin Wall, the release of Mandela, and later the election of Clinton. He began to make eye contact as he read his speech. Along with others, I hope for the better for a peace dividend in the United States that would give hope to the poor. It never came. Those in places of power who make money from military procurement could breathe a sigh of relief that it was deemed prudent the United States military remain unnaturally strong. My sister in Columbus, with 8 children to raise on her own, could find a way to get by, our leader said. The military contractors would not have to. We have schools in Mount Liberty, Mount Carl, Mount Dorothy, and Mount Jennifer, all around the district that need fixing. We've made staff cuts at our school. Many school boards are making the same sorts of heart-wrenching decisions for lack of money. Joe looked up, surprised that the people were actually listening. And yet we continue to build state and federal prisons at a rapid rate. The United States incarcerates a higher percentage of its population than any nation on earth. State governments invariably spend more on prisons and jails than on colleges and universities. Joe looked up and over, saw that Jane was standing in front of her seat, with one arm wrapped around the post in front of her, watching with rapt attention. When I went to my first newspaper interview in Mount Brittany, the reporter said, my ideas were out there. At least he knew that's what his readers would think. Well, I know what he meant. But nothing great is accomplished without ideals, without dreams, without putting forth proposals that at first seem really out there. And it is not failure but a low aim that is a crime. It's a mistake to regard idealism as a sentimental weakness. Joe put a touch of bass to his voice. He heard his voice going out. He knew where he was, but willed himself not to think about it. Those quotes came from the early Wilson era, when providing for the poor while seeking to limit the reach of the rich and powerful were talked about openly. Today, liberal is a swear word. Joe looked at his audience and paused. He shifted his feet and put pressure on his hands on the sides of the podium, portion of his brain imagining the podium pitching forth into the crowd. The real obscenity is the way political parties and politicians will stick their fingers into the air to check the wind and then sprint in that direction. I'm a Democrat because John Kennedy was a Democrat. My mother and father were Catholics and Democrats. Well, actually, my dad was a Catholic and Democrat because my mom was. That's the way it worked many times. Party affiliation passed across the breakfast table. On the first day ever of school, my kindergarten teacher, Miss Cole, wrote in gigantic yellow flaky letters on the blackboard, the size of that neon signboard on Times Square, President John F. Kennedy. Then we prayed for Kennedy in our third grade classroom with Sister Ellen on the day he was shot. Before that day, we thought the world was nice. Presidents were perfect. People in leadership had our best interest in mind. But since that time, we found out different. But the ideal remains. The governor, seated below, leaned to whisper something to the other candidate, Joe's opponent, who in turn tilted right to whisper to his wife, who laughed out loud and looked up at Joe Coffey. I did not choose to run because I suddenly felt qualified. I just realized that I wished that politicians, newspaper reporters, and news anchors talked about issues the way I wanted them to be talked about, as if they thought we had a brain in our head. Jane cheered with half a dozen others in the audience. She had not seen Joe's speech because she demanded he write it himself. Nobody comes around and asks you if you want to bomb Iraq or Kosovo or Afghanistan, whether you want 30 new federal prisons built this year. Nobody asks you if you want your son forced to sign up for military induction. Nobody asks you. So sometimes you just have to tell them how you feel. The state Democratic Party chairman leaned across the table to the county Democratic Party chair. "Where did you get this fool?" he asked. The county chair shrugged his shoulders. Another reporter asked me what I thought about health care and Social Security. I said I did not know. She said I had to know, but I said I did not. Social Security, Medicare, minimum wage, those are all important issues. The environment, immigration, all very important. There are 30 other important issues we could name. Until we come to grips with our idolatry of the military, the rest is secondary. Joe watched as the state chairman loudly pushed his chair back to stand and walked down the steps, up the aisle, and out the door as Joe began his next sentence. Reporters asked me why I am running. Well, do you remember way, way back, just after the Columbine tragedy? President Clinton asked our young people to find nonviolent ways to solve their problems. Well, that was while President Clinton and the rest of us adults were bombing Yugoslavia every morning, afternoon, and night. Our children are watching us every step we take, and they are down there, low, with a great perspective to be able to really see which direction we go. Joe began to speak slower, responding to a note he had scribbled in the margin. "Go slow, stupid." As he read, a voice, perhaps his own, told him he could do this. The administration is dominated and directed by wealth and for the accumulation of wealth. I believe that democracy has so far disappeared in the United States that no two evils exist. There is but one evil party with two names. It would be selected despite all I can do or say. That's W.E.B. Du Bois, co-founder of the NAACP, in 1956 saying why he would not vote. Many now take that option. We need to have variety, choice, and fire for democracy to work. The governor excused himself, waited for his wife to stand, then waved to the crowd as they walked away. The governor shook hands as he made his way up the middle aisle. I think it is important and healthy to have at least one nobody in this race, and I claim that distinction. Going around to get signatures, you can see the disgust on some people's faces the moment you say Democrat or Congress or running for office. They are frustrated with the process because it should be more open. If I can be up here, you can be up here too. We should be excited about the process, not resigned to its ultimate uselessness. The governor passed the maintenance man standing in the doorway, deciding to make the governor walk around him. A few delegates made their way to the side aisles to catch the governor with a request before he departed. Two reporters with camera bags slung over their shoulders, who had been leaning against the far wall taking notes as Joe spoke, flapped their notebooks closed and hurried to get a last photo and quote from the governor. It is true that you almost have to be a contract lawyer to figure out the difference between the Democrat and Republican parties. It shouldn't be that way. Politicians want to say nice things, the right things, in order to get elected. And when we get in, we really shake things up, we whisper. Well, you can see what Clinton did. He bailed out. Anyone with eyes or a heart can see what Obama did. Someone groaned in the mid-left section of the crowd. Joe noticed movement around him, a general impatience for his speech to be over. There was a reason to impeach President Clinton. It was not sex under an antique desk. It was the bombing of Iraq. The continued bombing of Iraq, the continued sanctions against Iraq, costing millions of lives, many of them children. It was a welfare reform bill that underlined our disdain for the poor. It was the 1996 crime bill that allocated $8 billion for new prisons. It was the attack and slaughter of the Branch Davidians at Waco. It was the murder of Randy Weaver's wife and son. It was the bombing of Afghanistan and Sudan in the summer of 1998. It was continued support for the drug war and the use of the death penalty. A few people applauded, others rustled paper. And can we agree that the crimes and omissions of the Obama administration are too obvious to have run down point by point? A sort of cough caused Joe to look up. Jane's loud clapping echoed. Joe stood on one leg, turned over his last page to find the rest of his speech. With all due respect, the standard Democratic platform is as boring as watching paint dry and just as useful. As the song goes, you have to sing like you don't need the money. Joe looked up, expecting applause or a chuckle. Our children expect, they just assume that this is a good world. Joe tried to speak slowly and louder. We owe it to them and to the child within ourselves not to give up on that ideal too soon. Thank you. Joe turned right to shake the MC's hand, but the committee man had sneaked in around on the left and was already speaking into the microphone to organize the lunch break. Some people clapped for Joe. Others turned to look at the clock on the balcony, and others leaned over seats and aisles to make lunch plans. A clipboard banged against a seat. And that's the news from Moonrock Lake, where all the police and soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats and journalists are cowards, and all the Homeland Security COINTELPRO lone gunmen are about average. The new American dream means never having to say some question or idea is not valid. We are allowed to ask any questions we have. There are no wrong questions. There's no hidden black military budget. There are no UFO files Americans cannot see. No JFK documents that will not be open during our lifetimes. No destroyed RFK murder photos by the LA police. No evidence from Ground Zero taken away before we can even look at it. We are not the USSR of the 1960s. This is supposed to be America. That is our dream, to become America, the new America, the real hope of the world. We have a dream of bringing United States politicians, journalists, and generals who brought about this long war and this debacle. Bring them to trial. Put them on TV just like OJ every afternoon so every American can watch, just like the McCarthy hearings and the JFK funeral procession. What we need is a new American dream, not of new homes and toasters and microwaves, but of becoming the kind of country we always thought we were. Right now we live on lies, we subsist on lies, but it's not really living. 9/11 was an inside job. They all know that. What we need in America is a truth commission like they had in South Africa to heal their broken country. We need to put certain people on the stand. We need to be allowed to ask questions because our country is surely broken as well. The troops are not protecting us. That is someone's spin on the day's news, somebody's advertising slogan, and someone else's sermon. The troops serve the empire. They are not heroes. They kill and plunder for the empire. American bases overseas serve nobody but the empire. The heroes in our country are the protesters, the ones who go face to face with the empire. Those in the plowshares movement, for one example. You have to know Donald Trump knows the whole truth about 9/11. He's complicit. He's lied. He's continued the wars everywhere based on a lie, and he knows he's lying. He lies right to our faces on national television, just like Barack Obama when he said that Osama bin Laden had been killed and buried at sea. Well, Osama bin Laden buried at sea. Jessica Lynch rescued heroically. USA does not torture. Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. George Bush won the 2000 election. See? There's a plane there in that hole in Shanksville. Went all the way into the hole. Now, no, there's no blood, no bodies, no luggage scattered, or plane parts. Osama bin Laden buried at sea. Remember the anthrax letters, etc. Are you afraid? Those are not written with a rock and chisel like Fred Flintstone from the recesses of some cave in Afghanistan. Those letters came from persons within our own government. Like a horror movie, the killer is in the same house with us. The killers are right here with us, and they want us to be afraid, and we cannot be afraid. Thank you for joining us tonight on the New American Dream Radio Show. We hope you'll be back next week and every week right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Thank you, Mike, and good night.
Thanks to you, Chuck, for all the work you did to make the show happen. And a shout-out to Lorraine. I hope you're feeling better soon. And thanks to our guests, Jim Fetzer, Richard Flamer, Thomas Wortman, Philip Peruzio, and Frank Cordero. Good night.